Good evening, and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Sarah Holliday, Library Events Coordinator, and as we begin, let me remind you please to turn off cell phones or anything that might beep at us during the event. When I graduated from college, I moved from Texas to New York City, and it took me a while to stop gawking at the Empire State Building and get used to the idea that I now lived in a city where so many movies are filmed, so many stories are set, so many immigrant journeys arrived, and so forth. Shriver Rhodes Pitts moved from Texas to New York City, not just to New York, though, but to Harlem, which is even more full of myths, history, and ghosts, many of them seldom acknowledged by the culture below about 110th Street. Harlem Is Nowhere is a compelling wander through geography, architecture, history, biography, and what the heck it all means now to people who live in those storied blocks and those who make a pilgrimage there. I was very excited when the publisher sent a copy for our New York City Book Awards, and I'm even more pleased to introduce its author now. This is her first book, but I'm sure all of us New Yorkers, new and old, hope many more will follow. Please join me in welcoming Shriver Rhodes Pitts.
Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me all right? I didn't know Sarah was also from Texas. Which is very important. I feel like the moment I arrived, I was always drawn to fellow Texans and fellow Southerners, which was one of the reasons why I felt really at home when I arrived in Harlem and began speaking with my neighbors. Some of them had arrived themselves from the South when they were young and had made that transition from being a rural Southerner to living in the middle of everything. And making that connection across years and generations was really part of what sparked me to write this book. I found I was constantly in conversations that would thrust me back many years into the past about situations and histories and everyday events that I'd only heard of or dreamed about. And that coexistence between the past and the present, where I could be walking the streets and speaking to a neighbor and they would suddenly start speaking to me about a building that wasn't there anymore, is what made me try to pursue this research, where in the book I also try to make the past and the present exist at the same moment, and also a few different types of knowledge exist in the same space. The knowledge that we gain when we go into libraries, into places like this, pull a book off the shelf and immerse ourselves for the better part of a day, or the kind of knowledge that you get when you're standing on the street corner, as one often is in Harlem, talking to a neighbor. Those are the ways I came to know things. And I wanted to share with you a section from the book called Searching for the Underground City. And the underground city is the library. It is, I come to find out in the middle of this chapter, it's the Schomburg Center, which is at the corner of 135th Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, which is also known as Lenox Avenue. When I lived in New York, I live in New Orleans now, but when I lived in New York, I lived two blocks from the Schomburg Center, and it was constantly the place I went to every day or every other day. It was a place where this book really took shape, and the way that library was founded is really important to me. And it's important to the history of Harlem. It wasn't just another library, it was also a means toward self-determination and freedom. So I want to speak a bit about this. I should actually talk to you about this photograph, because the library actually is involved in this. I heard someone say, what are we staring at? Which is a good question. By looking at it, it's hard to know. And when I looked at this picture, I said, it was hard to tell if it was something that's being built or something that's been destroyed. Harlem is a place that were there for many years. It's less true now. There are often open spaces between buildings because they'd been destroyed, sometimes by neglect, sometimes deliberately because landlords were destroying buildings in the 60s and 70s for insurance purposes. But this is actually, this photograph is from around 1880, and I happened upon it in a strange way. I went on a tour of my own neighborhood because I wanted to know what tourists were being told when they came to Harlem. And the tour met outside of the Schomburg Center, that place I knew so well, on the corner. And before anything began, the tour guide asked a question, which I'm going to ask to you as well. And she said, what is the first thing you think of when you hear the word Harlem? Yes, if you care to share your notions, music.
Mm-hmm.
The Cotton Club. Lots of music fans. Well, music was also a popular answer in that that day on the tour. People said music, people said riots, which I thought was an interesting juxtaposition. People said soul food, and people said Bill Clinton, which I thought was also strange, that they should think of Bill Clinton above many other things one could think of in Harlem. He's not the first one that comes to my mind, but I just listened to those answers. But the most captivating thing about that, the beginning of that tour for me, was this picture, which she passed around as a laminated photograph. And she explained to us that this picture was taken not very far from where we were standing at that moment. This is 133rd Street when it was being built, between 5th and Lenox Avenue. So Lenox is 6th Avenue. It changes names in Harlem, and later the name was officially changed to Malcolm X Boulevard. And this is actually right across the street from where I lived. I lived on Lenox Avenue. And it was just a sort of magical thing to look at this photo of a place that was so immediate and yet so changed, to see something in the middle of its creation, and then to see if it's very hard to see in this photograph, in this when it's blown up, but in the very, very distance there's a tree. And so you have a little small remnant of this landscape when it was wild. Harlem was built as a sort of extension of New York. It was really the countryside for so many years. And in the late 1880s, it became a center of speculation, real estate speculation. So a lot of people said, we're going to buy land in Harlem and build. And so the fact that there were three buildings here and then a gap and then three buildings there is because this was a speculative enterprise. Maybe a developer just had those three plots, and they built those buildings, and so on and so on, until eventually the street became complete. And this was just something that sparked a really strong reaction in me, to think about the fact that these houses themselves aren't there anymore. I don't know if you're familiar with Lenox Avenue around 135th Street, but there's the Lenox Terrace complex, which is about 9 towers that were built in the late 50s, maybe early 60s. And this is actually where Lenox Terrace stands. So there's 2 row houses still standing, and they house a religious order of nuns, and their housing was protected, but everything around it was destroyed in a slum clearance program in the 50s. And the towers went up. So this is just a strange, for a researcher, when you sort of stumble upon something, and there was no reference about who took this picture, where it came from, and it actually sparked a crazy search for me that lasted a few years, where I had to track down someone that worked for the tour company who secretly made a copy of it for me because the boss wouldn't let him give it away. And then sort of in the middle of doing other research, stumbled upon this picture. And it's the property of the New York Historical Library, of all places, so it wasn't that hard to find. But it's sort of much more of a romantic story the way I found it, I think. Anyway, I'm going to this is a picture I'm going to tell you some things about now in this chapter, Searching for the Underground City. I found a picture in the digital archive of the library. The circumstances were not extraordinary. I was not looking for anything in particular. I had merely typed the word Harlem into the image archive and waited to see what it would yield. The picture shows an intersection, but nothing about the juncture is immediately recognizable. A large apartment building sits in the background, and in the foreground stands a man and a boy. The back of the man is turned against the camera. The boy is in partial profile. They are watching the scene coming toward them and toward me. The scene is only people walking. It is not remarkable. The men all wear dark suits with waistcoats and fedoras or newsboy caps. There is a woman in the group wearing a skirt of black organdy that shines against the dominating flatness in view. Another group stands under the awning of a storefront, their backs also turned against the camera. The store sign, W.A. Holly, pharmacist, is crowded alongside advertisements for Coca-Cola and other billboards. One promotes a new comedy called Three East. At ground level is a sign for straw hats, a partially obscured sign for a cigar shop, and another sign that says drugs. At the left edge of the frame is the slightest suggestion of street furniture, a lamppost or subway entrance. There's an unidentifiable piece of debris on the pavement. Most people in the picture walk determinedly in the typical city dweller's trance, but one walker, forever caught in the middle distance, is worth noting. His hands are in his pockets. His upper body torques as if he is turning mid-step to greet a friend. There is something familiar in his stance. It is the strut of a Harlem dandy, and his descendants can still be seen in the streets. Although the quality of the photo is poor, and the camera is too far away to capture any defining features, there is the faintest flash of white where his mouth would be. He is in the middle of a shout or a smile. An apartment building occupies the background on the far side of the intersection. Just visible in a few of the upper story windows are figures looking out from their apartments, people surveying the happenings on the street, keeping watch from within. No one looks at the camera. I can tell from the clothing of the walkers that the picture dates to the 1910s. The shadows should tell me the time of day, but I can't decipher the angle at which they fall. It is a Harlem street scene. It is another Harlem street scene. It is not an especially crowded scene, so it does not tell the story of Harlem's legendary crowdedness. The people are elegantly dressed, so it does not tell the story of Harlem's legendary destitution. The comedy advertised on the billboard is the movie adaptation of a 1919 stage play of no great distinction, the story of a minister's daughter who comes to New York, lives in a boarding house, winds up a chorus girl, and then falls in love. So it does not tell the story of Harlem's legendary artistic outpouring of racial consciousness. In fact, the story that captured my attention was not told by the photograph itself, but by its caption. The picture is titled, Within 30 Seconds Walk of the 135th Street Branch. Nothing indicates whether these words were fixed to this image by its maker or by its cataloger. It gives information not contained within the frame. There is no street sign in view alerting us that this corner is the intersection of 135th Street and Lenox Avenue. For the caption's author, the crucial thing was not the exact location. We do not learn whether you would reach this scene by walking north, south, east, or west. Essentially, the caption does not describe what the photo shows. Instead, it offers a lesson about the perspective that has nothing to do with the position of the photographer's camera. According to the caption, the people we're looking at and their various activities are not of primary importance. The scene is only important in relation to what is nearby. For the author of the caption, defining this image in the official record, the crucial thing was time. 30 seconds was all it took to go out and meet this scene. Its significance is in its distance from the library. All things in the street refer back to the library, just as the hour of the day around the world is determined by one's distance from Greenwich. I scan the image looking for some other sign and wonder how many times I have hurried over that very spot. It has the character of a clue from a treasure hunt. Within 30 seconds walk of the 135th Street branch, you will find. But there is a tear in the parchment. It is not possible to hunt treasure with such incomplete instructions. Within 30 seconds walk of the library, you will find a halal grill cart manned by Egyptians and West African women standing at the subway entrance, selling the Daily News and the New York Post. Walk in another direction, you will find the Yemeni bodega where I go for tea and junk food while working at the library. At the intersection of 135th and Lenox, within 30 seconds walk of the library, I once found a man toting a portable xylophone who offered to play me a song. He walked with me in the direction of my building, chiming his keys, but he would not tell me, when I asked, the name of the tune he played. He acted as if it were an insult to ask and a blasphemy to answer. Within 30 seconds' walk of the library, just near the corner of 136th Street, a handsome and serious-looking African man sells incense, perfume oils, and shea butter. Watching him during my breaks from the library, I notice that he usually is not minding his wares, but sits planted beneath a sidewalk tree, reading the Quran, making notes, and manipulating a length of prayer beads. I imagine him to be a diligent scholar of Islamic law and wonder how he came to be a street merchant outside the library. One day, taking my break under a nearby tree, I saw that he'd been joined at his station and in his activity by two attentive students. I could not hear his voice, but the tender incantations of his young charges, timidly repeating their lessons for review, carried over the sound of the traffic from that makeshift classroom beneath a shade tree. First they answered in concert, then each child spoke alone. The smaller of the two boys struggled to stay focused. He scribbled hurriedly in his composition book when his eyes were not darting up and into the crowd, as if searching for clues in the faces of the people streaming by. Before moving to Harlem, I often visited the library as a college student during trips to New York. At the time, I didn't think of this as going to Harlem because I was going to the library. Technically, when setting out on such journeys, I was already in Harlem because I always stayed with a boyfriend who lived just north of Columbia University. If I'd been more enterprising, I could have walked to the library or taken a series of buses, but instead I'd take the local 1 or 9 line from its elevated tracks at 125th Street and Broadway, downtown to 96th Street. From there, I would change to the express train back uptown to 135th Street via the 2 or 3 line, which deposited me directly at the library door. When I came up from this station, it was necessary to get my bearings. This was not difficult. On one side of the intersection was at 135th and Lenox was the hospital. On the other side was the library. I could invent for you a street scene of a decade past, some loud summer noise or curious encounter, but they would be just that, inventions, because I don't remember a thing. I don't remember a thrill that was then specific to being in Harlem. The thrill was in the library. Harlem was the place I rushed past to meet it. The library was my true destination. Once inside, I settled into work. My research at the time was scattered but intense. I went to the library armed with a list of topics, usually for some writing project that was never accomplished. The library was where I read the history of the Scottsboro trial. I read about the Black Madonna shrine scattered around Europe, deciphering the controversy about whether the faces of the Madonna statues had been black intentionally, perhaps hearkening back to dark goddess worship beginning with Isis, or whether the image had become blackened through the operation of time and the residue of smoke from candles burned by her devotees. I studied minstrel shows. I read about the Great Migration and about the public execution of a 12-year-old slave girl in 1786. All these subjects consumed me at the time, the answers to a series of questions whose urgency I have since forgotten. Even though the hours spent at the library in those years did not produce any tangible achievement, my pilgrimages were carried out with a great sense of purpose. I was in the place I needed to be to know all things, but my visits to the city were brief. I would leave the library and dash out past Harlem, back to New York. Looking at my own old photographs, I found a strange souvenir of those days, a picture I do not remember making of a vista I don't recall having admired. It is a street scene, a Harlem street scene. It shows the intersection of 135th and Lenox, looking south down Lenox and taken from a slightly elevated view. When I first discovered the picture, it took some moments to understand how I could have achieved such an angle. Looking closer, a slight glare revealed that it was taken through a window. I soon realized only one place could have offered this particular vantage point, the library. Perhaps I'd abandoned my research that day and had been staring out the window, but I was looking out at nothing in particular. I did not train my lens on an event taking place in the distance or on any specific person. The clothes of the people in the street reveal that it was winter, but there are no shadows by which to tell the time of day. Another picture in the library shows the point of departure for that 30-second journey. It is the reading room of the 135th Street branch in 1935. A group of fashionable aesthetes are gathered for a portrait. They sit in a formal semicircle, some with some in chairs and others standing behind in a second row. The static composure of these figures suggests none of the clamor that could be found in the intersection just a few yards away. The, quote, staff and friends of the Negro division of the 135th Street Library occupy a distant realm. The gentlemen sit with legs placidly crossed and arms folded in their laps. The women tuck their ankles in quiet propriety. One man wears white spats over his shoes. Some of the women hold pocketbooks. The ladies are coiffed with hairstyles plastered into finely marcelled curls. One woman's dress fastens with a multitude of buttons. Another woman wears a corsage. In the center of the room is an Italian marble sculpture of the great 19th century actor Ira Aldridge as Othello at the moment when he mournfully clutches Desdemona's handkerchief. Around the room, framed pictures hang salon style and brown busts decorate the tops of bookshelves. In the background, African masks jut out from the wall. Standing in the back row, unassuming, is Arthur Schomburg, the man whose collection was housed in that library, the man whose search for origins made the place a destination. What became the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture began as the 135th Street branch of the New York Public Library. Indeed, the now world-renowned special collection was at first just a few files of newspaper clippings in black history, curated by a white librarian, Ernestine Rose, and her black assistant, Catherine Latimer. Upon arriving at that post in 1920, at the moment when the slowly accumulating mass of blacks was beginning to assert its permanence and purpose in Harlem, Ernestine Rose devoted herself to creating a facility that might answer the question posed by the crowd in the streets nearby. As she saw it, quote, instead of considering the Negro problem, shall we not treat the Negroes as individuals with the opportunities and restrictions which surround all individuals? If the street was the place where Black Harlem constituted the Negro problem, where people were only of sociological interest, then the library would be a temple of the individual, worshiping the personal aspirations and collective triumphs of black people and their culture. The purpose of the 135th Street branch, articulated early on by Rose, was, quote, to preserve the historical records of the race, to arouse the race consciousness and race pride, to inspire art students, and to give information to everyone about the Negro. Rose and Latimer set up a program of poetry readings and book discussions, and most important, they began to build a small collection of books, periodicals, and clippings related to the history of black people in Africa and America. The novelist Nella Larson worked there as a librarian. The young poets County Cullen and Langston Hughes were regular patrons. Of course, a great many other seekers whose purposes and accomplishments will never be known also came to the library. The Black History Collection soon became so popular that the librarians, after consulting with the Committee of Local Intellectuals, removed the items from general circulation in the Lending Library, keeping them on the upper floor of the branch, where they could only be retrieved for reference on the premises. The few books available on black history were so frequently used and so much in demand that many hard-to-find and irreplaceable books were read until they fell apart. By the time this mania for the black past was unfolding at the 135th Street Library, Arthur Schomburg was already a noted bibliophile, well known for the breadth and value of his collection and the ardor with which he pursued it. Schomburg belonged to a circle of race men who were also book fiends, sharing and trading recent acquisitions. Before there was such thing as the New Negro Movement, he had co-founded the Negro Society for Historical Research, was a member of the Negro Book Collectors Exchange, and had served as president of the American Negro Academy. These organizations were all ambitious in their aims, and they were all short-lived, but their existence tells us much about the spirit of their age. The desire of these men to uncover the forgotten history of black people was matched by a desire to protect and steward that knowledge. The books and documents Schomburg and his colleagues hunted were precious, and they had to compete with better-funded white collectors. According to one account, Schomburg once refused to sell his collection to a wealthy white man because the prospective buyer wouldn't reveal his plans for the materials. Upon learning that many white institutions had impressive collections of historic black books, Schomburg wrote to a friend, quote, "You would be surprised to know that the libraries in the South who bar the Negroes' admittance have a large amount of his literature." Arturo Alfonso Schomburg was a native of Puerto Rico, born to a German father and a black mother. His interest in black history was sparked when a teacher told him that black people had no history. By the time he was living in Brooklyn and making a respectable middle-class living as a mail clerk at a bank, he was still passionately attempting to refute that charge. Schomburg was said to have a magic sense that guided his quest for new material, spending his lunch hours and weekends digging through New York's antiquarian bookstores. In his search for treasure, Schomburg corresponded with other collectors around the country and abroad, including Haiti and Liberia. He drafted friends into his research, sending requests to travelers like James Weldon Johnson, Langston Hughes, and Elaine Locke when they were just about to depart for sojourns in Europe. He also traveled around the country, partly because of his duties as a Freemason. In addition to collecting, Schomburg produced monographs and papers on neglected black figures from world history. His pamphlet, Is Haiti Decadent?, investigated the political situation of that country leading up to and in the midst of the American occupation, which lasted from 1915 to 1935, about. He researched and wrote of notable men of African descent who made important but sometimes forgotten contributions to world history, including the Chevalier de Saint-Georges, the Guadeloupe-born composer and courtier, Anthony Maceo, a black officer in the struggle for Cuban independence from Spain, Alessandro, the Florentine Duke who was known as the Negro Medici, and Leo Africanus, the Moorish geographer from Grenada, a place Schomburg visited during his only journey in Europe. In 1925, the 135th Street Branch Library hosted an exhibition featuring a small assortment of Schomburg's collection. Quote, "There is a Negro exhibit at the New York Public Library," one report began. "Within a dozen cases, there lies the story of a race. A dozen cases, narrow, shallow, compressed, and yet through their clear glass tops, there shines that which arrests, challenges, commands attention." Writing of that same exhibition without mentioning that the collection on display was his own, Schomburg issued what may have been a challenge to that old school teacher who had robbed him of his claim to history. "Not long ago," he wrote, "the Public Library of Harlem housed a special exhibition of books, pamphlets, prints, and old engravings that simply said, to skeptic and believer alike, to scholar and schoolchild, to proud black and astonished white, here is the evidence." The exhibit was so well received that in 1926, the New York Public Library, with a grant from the Carnegie Corporation, purchased the entire collection for $10,000. The Schomburg accession included more than 5,000 books, 3,000 rare manuscripts, 2,000 etchings and portraits, clippings, albums, and several thousand pamphlets. Among the treasures were original manuscripts of poems by Paul Laurence Dunbar, an original signed edition of Phyllis Wheatley's poems, and an original proclamation of Haitian independence signed by Toussaint Louverture. Schomburg's collection was added to the existing holdings at the 135th Street branch, forming the New York Public Library's Division of Negro History, Literature, and Prints. Though he relinquished ownership of his collection, Schomburg did not give up its stewardship or his quest. He continued to acquire items, and in 1932 was appointed curator of the Negro Division, overseeing the fulfillment of his vision until his death in 1938. The original 135th Street branch building still stands. It is one of several libraries in Harlem dating back to the philanthropic atonements of the Gilded Age, all funded by Andrew Carnegie and all featuring facades in the Palladian style. The Schomburg Center was enlarged in 1977. The new addition was made to connect to the old building via an atrium, though its style does not at all communicate with the old one. One is a civilizing fantasy of the European Renaissance, the other a purifying fantasy of Afrocentric brutalism. After the library closes in the evening, the upper rooms of the old library remain lit. Walking across 135th Street at night, I am often startled by the shadows that can be seen through the ivy-colored windows. They are only busts and statues in a windowsill, their silhouettes throwing outlines against the drawn blinds. But at first, they look like moving figures, busy in the library after dark. That's one section. Thanks. Why don't I show you a few more pictures, and then if you'd like, I can read a little bit more from a different section. We'll see. So that's the searching for the underground city. I just was struck, as I mentioned, by what's happening outside of the frame. Literally, the Schomburg Center would be like there. And all of this, this incredible street life energy that you feel in this picture was also being directed in the library, where people who had just arrived from down south were thrust into city life, and maybe the library was a refuge for them and a place where they could seek out some way to make sense of the situation they were in. So that's just a favorite picture of mine. This is a picture that I first encountered when I was a teenager in Texas, in my high school library, actually. It was taken by Aaron Siskind, and during the 1930s and early 40s, he pursued a documentary photography project in Harlem. It's called the Harlem. The book that was published eventually was called Harlem Document. And most of the pictures are kind of your typical street life, or sometimes he would go inside people's houses and take pictures of people that lived in troubled situations and tenements in poverty. And then there was this section of photos where there was no one at all, and just pictures of boarded up buildings. And when I was a kid, it posed a riddle to me, because I was already really aware of the Harlem Renaissance and the stories of the jazz clubs and the idea of Harlem as this kind of golden place full of great achievement. And then this is actually one of the more well-maintained buildings, but many of the Siskind photographs of boarded up buildings were sort of in disrepair. And at the time, I didn't know enough about Harlem history or about history, period, to understand that paradox, that Harlem could be a place that was celebrated for achievement and this outpouring of political and artistic inspiration, and then also a place that was abandoned and forsaken and disavowed and boarded up and forgotten. And as I got older and even as I moved to Harlem, I began to understand the history of what happened in Harlem when black people first began to move into the neighborhood, which is a story I tell in the book. Maybe I should read some of that section. But what the part of this might be, we don't know for sure, because you can never know the history of any photograph that doesn't come with much information, but it always sparks a sort of inquiry. And what this photograph made me think about as I learned more of the history of Harlem, which was when black people move to Harlem, white people abandon it quite frequently, preferring to board up a house rather than have a black neighbors. And so this picture made me think of that, which is the sort of wholesale abandonment of Harlem because of white supremacy and racism that allowed the neighborhood to sort of fall and disappear, that allowed many perfectly fine houses to go unused and unoccupied. So that's Aaron Siskind's Harlem Document. And this is an interesting photograph of another place that doesn't exist any longer. It's, as you can see with the bright signage, the House of Common Sense and the Home of Proper Propaganda, World History Book Outlet. And it was located near the corner of 7th Avenue, which is now at Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Boulevard, and 125th Street. What stands there now is the State Office Building, which is the tall building was project that was built by Rockefeller that's now named for Adam Clayton Powell, but has an interesting history because Powell himself protested the building, that building even existing. It was, they raised a bunch of businesses like this and built this tower above Harlem, and there was a huge protest and even occupation, not much different than we're seeing downtown, where people camped out in order to stop the building being built. It was built, and then years later, it was named for Adam Clayton Powell, who detested it. But anyway, this building, this I feel like is another expression of that same urge that we see happening in the library of self-discovery and asserting one's place in history and in the American imagination through knowledge, through the pursuit of knowledge. And this was a place that was, it was owned by a man named Louis Michaud, who's himself was a bibliophile and collector. And it was a center for politics. People would have meetings here. You can see on one of the smaller signs, it was the repatriation headquarters for the Back to Africa movement. So I think an important stream through Harlem's history is the place of knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge and the creation of the Black American narrative that's often overwritten. And so you have these very public centers where that's possible. And this is one of them. So that, what else do I have here? End of slideshow. I guess that's it. Yeah. Those were just some of my favorites. Let's see. I'll read a small section more, and then I'll take some questions, if you like. This is a small sort of capsule history that I put into the book just because it was something that I stumbled upon again in the library. The whole book does not take place in the library. I'm just reading you those sections because here we are. A lot of it takes place on street corners and political meetings. Some of it's historical, some of it's personal. But this section, while it's historical, is very personal to me because it's the story of the White Rose Industrial Association, which was founded in Harlem. I'll tell you the founding of it and the history. During the years when New York was swelling with newcomers from Europe's shores, Victoria Earle Matthews established a refuge specializing in the welfare of those not included in Lady Liberty's huddled masses. Mrs. Matthews, prominent in New York's Black society and the daughter of a Georgia slave, founded the White Rose Home in 1897, providing classes in cooking and sewing to Black women, along with meals and education to the children of the Black poor. The White Rose was similar to the mission societies and settlement houses then opening in New York for the uplift and assimilation of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. It filled a need those other charities did not address, for at the White Rose, quote, "sometimes a few little Italians and Jewish children come in with the others and they are never turned away. But the settlement is there for the dark-skinned little Americans who are not very welcome elsewhere." Mrs. Matthews expanded this program of good works when she was called upon by a friend to give hospitality to a young girl from Jacksonville, Florida, arriving in New York to seek employment. Victoria Matthews arranged to meet the girl at the docks. The young traveler would wear a red ribbon drawn through a buttonhole in her coat. According to the memoir of a White Rose Home associate writing in 1925, quote, "although Mrs. Matthews was at the dock promptly, one of those unprincipled men who haunted the wharves in those days, and to some extent do still, managed to seize upon the girl and lure her away from the wharf. To the most earnest inquiries, only one answer was received. Yes, such a girl was aboard, but nothing had been seen of her since the boat landed. A general alarm was sent out, but nothing was heard of the girl until she wandered back to the wharf after 3 days. She could not locate the place to which she had been taken, but her experience was sad and bitter. She was sent back home, and Mrs. Matthews resolved that she would use all her energies in seeking to prevent another such disastrous occurrence." Thus, the White Rose Industrial Association took up its new mission to be, quote, "a friend to the strange girl in New York, a sanctuary for the migrant." "Let us call it the White Rose," Mrs. Matthews declared. "I shall always feel that the girls will think of the meaning, purity, goodness, and virtue, and strive to live up to our beautiful name." Acting as an unauthorized society for the aid of travelers, Mrs. Matthews and her collaborators took turns at the pier in order to meet every steamer of the Old Dominion line arriving from the principal southern port of Norfolk, Virginia. They delivered the witless and lonely travelers out of the hands of job sharks and into a setting where they could find, quote, "pleasant lodgings for girls with privilege of music and reading rooms, dining rooms, kitchen, and laundry, offered at reasonable rates." In some cases, the neediest wayfarers were housed for free. By 1925, more than 30,000 girls and young women had passed through the doors of the White Rose home. Quote, some were well-educated, earnest, of sterling worth, capable, and willing to take care of themselves, needing only the advice and encouragement of a good woman. Others were in need of help in many ways. They had no money, no knowledge of the great ways of the city, no friends. They were sheltered, guided, fed, clothed when necessary. Many taught to work acceptably in the homes of the metropolis, and many others saved from lives of shame. The original White Rose home was located on the Upper East Side. By 1918, when the black population of New York was in the midst of its move to Harlem, the White Rose home followed, leasing and then purchasing a brownstone on West 136th Street. When young women like Emma Lou, Ludi, Helga Crane, and Pinky, these are all characters from Harlem Renaissance novels that I've mentioned earlier in this chapter I'm reading, when they arrived in Harlem, they could find a warm bed and companionship in its elegant rooms. But the White Rose was more than an employment agency or a rooming house. It also provided moral guidance. How the custodians of the home kept their charges away from the nearby speakeasies, taverns, and ballrooms is unrecorded. The young women received assistance in job placement and classes in, quote, race history. Whereas the domestic training was necessary for the new arrivals to make a living in the very limited field of work available to black women, the classes in literature and race history were a particular passion of Mrs. Matthews. She was a writer and an intellectual. Her own development had been encouraged by an employer who interrupted her in reverie while she was supposed to be dusting the books in his library. In 1905, the original White Rose home was said to possess one of the most unique special libraries in New York. It included works by Booker T. Washington, Charles Chestnut, and Paul Laurence Dunbar, rare volumes like a 1773 second edition of Phyllis Wheatley's poetry, a bound edition of the 1859 Anglo-African magazine, which gave an account of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry and his subsequent trial and execution, and several narratives of escaped slaves. If Matthews provided the tools of domesticity, including a good stock of aprons, dust caps, and dusters always on hand, her library and classes held their own utility. And she said, our history and individuality as a people not only provide material for masterly treatment, but would seem to make a race literature a necessity as an outlet for the unnaturally suppressed inner lives which our people have been compelled to lead. The library of the White Rose home provided a shelter for souls based on the conviction that racial uplift could be accomplished by young women whose only value in the white world was as maids. Thus, she hoped to inspire in them confidence in their group and in themselves, confidence and a hope that she believed would incite them to noble thoughts and great ideas and deeds. Who dares to estimate to what extent her dream was realized? The 70th anniversary of the White Rose home was celebrated in 1967 on the society pages of the Amsterdam News in an article that bordered notices about a Mardi Gras ball, the installation of the new officers of the Imperial Elks home, marriage announcements, the Founders' Day festivities for a sorority. In addition to its purpose to avert the perdition of innocence, the White Rose had also become something of a society enterprise. The archives of the White Rose held at the Schomburg Center preserve the records of regular garden parties, annual linen showers, gypsy teas featuring performances of operettas, and a teabag festival that raised money for roof repair by imploring invited guests to drop herein 3 pennies for every year old. Upon its 1967 anniversary, the house on 136th Street still received lodgers in its dormitory rooms, which could be decorated to the taste of the occupant. The whole house had been recently renovated, reported in the Amsterdam News. Quote, the rooms retained their soft, nostalgic glow with its home-like atmosphere. Pale yellow walls in the first floor meeting room provide a cheerful background for the mahogany paneling and treasured antiques. One, a chair from the home of the founder, is one of the most revered pieces. The article is illustrated by a picture of 3 members of the White Rose Home and Industrial Association and a clergyman attending the anniversary occasion. They flank the empty chair of founder Victoria Earle Matthews. One woman lays a hand upon its seat, as if in supplication to a holy relic. One day I went to find the White Rose home. It had been operational, in name at least, into the early 1980s. I found it on a street of brownstones that were plain and modest in comparison with the distinctive manses of nearby Stryver's Row. An arrangement of silk flowers adorned the exterior window boxes. The building was well kept, and the address was fixed to the front in oversized gilt numbers. I thought of knocking on the door to gain entry. Instead, I stood across the street to have a better view. Soon, a man came to the house, walked up the stairs, and went in. I tried to look as though I was not paying unusual attention to his home, while half wishing it had been open to receive me upon arriving in Harlem with a suitcase full of tales. That's all. Thank you. Thanks. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, sure. Okay.
Was it at all successful here in Africa?
Mm-hmm.
Was the destination?
Yeah, that's a whole book, many books even. And it transcends Harlem itself. But Harlem was certainly like a focusing point of those feelings. It still is, actually. Where does it begin? It begins in the early 1800s with some abolitionists, some pro-slavery Southerners trying to figure out a way to deal with the problem in their mind of free blacks who under slavery posed a problem in American society because they were not enslaved, but they did not have the rights of free white men. And so people began to devise an idea of sending free blacks back to Africa. That's one end point. In the 1850s, and sort of like 1820s to 1850s, right up until the Civil War, this idea sort of gains traction, also among black people themselves, with the support of, by this point, mostly white Southerners. It became a sort of a conservative idea. In order to preserve the Union and preserve slavery, this population had to be dealt with. So enterprises were actually developed to gather people together. And there was a group called the American Colonization Society that made plans to, the country Liberia was actually founded by the American Colonization Society. And groups did go, and that caused a bunch of problems because it caused, imported really a class and caste system from America where the American colonists, the black American colonists became the ruling class. And to some degree, they still are. Some of the descendants of those people are still part of the ruling class in Liberia. And there were other even less successful attempts at this. We're back to Africa was one idea. To the Caribbean was a different idea that people had. I'm right now in the middle of starting research for my second book, which is about Haiti, and I discovered the story of a very unsuccessful attempt based from the same movement to have blacks immigrate to Haiti. And there was one particular island where these people ended up, and there was sort of a swindle where this American, a white American man who was living in Haiti claimed that he had the rights to this island that's off the coast of Haiti, and he would bring people there and give them land, and it was just a disaster, and people ended up dying of yellow fever. So it has a really, really long backstory. In the 20th century and in Harlem, it's revived by Marcus Garvey. I don't know if you're familiar with his name or his history, but he was a mass leader, a politician, and around the time, say, the rise of the NAACP, which was founded in 1911, he was gathering people with a slightly more radical idea of how to overcome racism in America, and part of it depended on an idea of a very simple idea of self-determination and owning businesses and controlling, having your own land. And but another wider part of his idea was that there would be a repatriation to Africa. And so this picture, the picture I showed you, is actually from the 60s, like early 60s. But and the Garvey movement formally had ended by then, but certainly his ideas are still very important. And well, that's just a short answer to your question. There's many more crevices one could go into. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? Yes.
It's not personal. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It's not too personal, and it's complicated. Well, when I moved here, I always sort of knew that I didn't plan on staying. It was not really that clear, but I just had a sense that I would not be here that long. And I didn't, one thing I should say, which I didn't say before, was that I didn't move here to write the book. I moved to New York, I graduated from college, and I had traveled a little bit and lived at home in Texas for a while and wanted to be a writer, but had no idea how that was going to happen exactly. While I was traveling, I was lucky to meet some editors and get some writing assignments while I was traveling. And then I saved money at a temp sort of office job when I was living in Texas and then moved to New York. And I always sort of knew that I wanted to live in Harlem. And it was partly seeded by something I describe in the book, which is just reading all these novels, Harlem Renaissance novels and poets and music. And so that place was very alive to me even before I really stepped foot there. And when I did come to New York, Harlem, you know, I sort of went and bought the Amsterdam News because that's where I knew I could find a decently priced apartment. And there it was. I never really considered Brooklyn or any other place. It was just Harlem for me. So, but that sense of transience was also there. I never said I'm going to live. This is my place. This is my city. I always thought maybe I would end up back in Texas eventually. But as I mentioned at the beginning, it was just that process of meeting people in the street and being inundated by the history of this place that sparked me and compelled me to start writing. It wasn't a project I arrived and said, I'm moving to Harlem to write this book about Harlem. It was completely kind of accidental that this book came up. And I immersed myself in that and wrote a long essay about Harlem that became the seed of the book. And once the project was actually underway, I was just sort of buried in it because it was the place I was living, just my day-to-day life, and then it was also a subject of research. And eventually, those lines were constantly blurring, you know. I didn't conduct formal interviews, for instance, for the book. A lot of people think it's like a very straightforward research book, but it really was born out of like the everyday like stuff of life and fragments and things that I, you know, as it was happening, I didn't even know what was going to end up in the book, but sort of things I was observing or things I wrote down when I was in the street, if it was a sign that caught my eye, you know, all those things went into the book. That was my own kind of strange way of researching. So it was my life. And I don't really understand it, but once the book was done, I was also sort of done with New York. And some of it was just about my own sense of like how I needed to live. And I traveled, I'd left in the middle of writing it and lived in Scotland for a year and I was really pleased that there's an exhibit about gardens because I'm a gardener and I really wanted a little plot of my own somewhere. And all those things were sort of urgings that I was just having to deal with and just what I felt like was sort of a harshness that I was not cut out for. So that was part of why I left. And New Orleans came about in a strange way, which is that I'd spent time in New Orleans in 2005 in the spring just before Hurricane Katrina. And it was a complete accident. Like I just was, you know, one of those moments when I was trying to leave town all the time, like leaving New York all the time. And I went to New Orleans for just a break and like a more gentle environment. And I was thrust into this place. I was living in a neighborhood, I live there now, called Treme, which you may know the name now from the HBO series. It's kind of, but it's not a name people really knew before that. But when I got to Treme in 2005 in the spring, I was actually at the beginning, very beginning of this process. I was just writing a book proposal for it, actually. It was just a little glimmer. And I was sitting on my porch one day down there, and this man sort of came up and was observing me because I had a notebook or something, so he started talking to me. What was I doing? What was I writing? And I told him I was a writer and I lived in New York in Harlem. And he said, oh, you're from Harlem? He said, welcome to Treme, the original Harlem of America. And what he meant by that, and what he went on to describe to me, is that Treme is actually known, I mean, it's one of those things when these declarations are often disputed, but it's known as the oldest black neighborhood in America. It has its own long history, but that same sense of a place that was a center and sort of a defining place for the culture of black people was here. I sort of stumbled into it in New Orleans. And so even though I was only there for a month that spring, and then suddenly, you know, New Orleans was very much on everyone's mind just a few months later with the disaster of this, the natural disaster and the unnatural disaster of Hurricane Katrina. It was on the back of my mind. And this, in 2010, I was supposed to go to Haiti to start researching my next book in January of 2010, in fact. And it was a really thing where my publisher like didn't send me a check in time, so I didn't have my funds to go. And there it was, like sort of the earthquake happened. So I didn't really know what to do, and it took me a long time, and I'm still just now like figuring it out. But like the point of a book, or why does one write a book, became like very impossible to me about in that moment. And this book was all but done, just a few things left to do. But I went to New Orleans to take up a writing residency just for 6 weeks and work on a smaller project that was unrelated to any of this, but just sort of figure out what to do next, since I wasn't going to be carrying on with my Haiti research that year. And I just ended up staying. And I ended up back in Treme, actually back on the same street where I lived in 2005. And I have a garden. And it's just, it's another place that pulls you in and won't let you go. And that is, there's stories coming out of every inch of the place. And those, it's things I'm just getting used to now. And as it happens, I'm planning to get on to Haiti in January of 2012. Because that work is still to be done. But that's sort of the weird story of how I left, sort of wandering here, wandering away, wandering back. But yeah, thanks. So, yes. No, there's not an address on the, you know, all I have is the way it was notated in the archive, and there were no addresses. And a friend of mine who's an architectural historian, when the book came out, he said, Sharifa, I don't know where that house is for sure. He said he wasn't, like, it's published as part of Siskin's Harlem document, and there are other houses that are also boarded up that are distinctly Harlem, and I think that was even, the fact that I chose that one, that was the one he started to challenge me and said, well, I don't know. It's, again, not knowing where it is. But so many townhouses, I mean, as you probably know, have been renovated and restored. And then so many others, even less now because empty lots are being bought up and things are being built there. But, you know, I remember when I first arrived, you could sort of walk down certain streets and there would just be a stoop, you know, or there would even just be, like, a door frame. Right. Well, the picture was taken in the 30s or 40s, so his photography project in Harlem was like sort of during the Depression. It was funded partly by the WPA. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Welcome. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, as I mentioned, my process for this book, at least, was much more informal. And so I had a lot of stories from people who were my neighbors who sort of took me in and told, let me, you know, sort of borrowed my ear and I sort of listened to them and their experiences. A lot of them were people that came here, though, because I was all, I guess I was always interested in speaking to my elders and that story of migration and people who raised their families here and things like that. So certainly the stories that I heard most were people who maybe arrived in the 40s and 50s from down south. And then I have friends, you know, that, I mean, people who are my age, and they talk about their families arriving in the 20s. And I just love, I mean, some of it's really great because in some cases they're people that, like, I have one friend whose family arrived in the 20s and she still lives in the same house where she grew up. And then another friend, her family arrived back during the Great Migration, but she was raised in Queens, and she's a visual artist, and she recently moved back to Harlem, and so she's sort of making full circle. And another friend, similar story, where he grew up in the Bronx and in Brooklyn, but his family was rooted in Harlem, and he's moved back and opened businesses. So I just am always really inspired by people who have that multi-generation connection to the place and those stories, and Certainly, I mean, Stryver's Row and Sugar Hill and all those places were places of great wealth in some cases. You know, I just saw Harry Belafonte last night at the New York Public Library, which was stunning. And today I read an interview that he did for a local magazine, and he talks about that, that very reality, which is that under, I mean, New York was not formally segregated, but just under the de facto segregation, everyone lived together, whether you were doing really, really well or not, and how, and the effect that had on people. And he grew up in Harlem as well. His family was Jamaican, but he was raised there. So it was, I think that's an important point. And because my researches are, I'm the first to declare that my researches are idiosyncratic and driven both by my obsessions and by the proximity of what happens to happen to me, you know? So there's always so many more stories to be told, and certainly there's, like, every person is a history book there and elsewhere. Thank you all for being here tonight. I appreciate your attention and presence. Mm-hmm. Hello.
We do have copies of the books for sale at the back, and our friends from the Corner Bookstore will be happy to sell you one. Thank you.